Land Use. It is 8:41. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, sir.
We're going to open this morning on House Bill 2909, open a public hearing. Committee, this bill is being worked with some amendments at this time, and we'll kind of delay until those amendments are ready to in the I'm trying to save time. The committee at this point has 121 bills to be heard, and we have a May 13th date as our last committee meeting at this point, so the chair has a great deal of homework to do. So we will be bringing back 2909 when the amendments are ready, so we'll close the public hearing on 2909 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3016. And Ross Day. Good morning, Mr. Day.
You want to run a clock on these guys, Mr. Chair, or do we just...
No, I think we have time this morning.
I will be brief. At least I'll try to be brief. Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ross Day, Director of Legal Affairs for Oregonians in Action. Before you today, you have House Bill 3016, which what the intent of the bill is, and I'm pretty sure this is what it does. It basically says that if you have dwellings in a unincorporated zone outside of an urban growth boundary, rather than requiring them each to have their own septic system. They can go out, and if it's practical and if it works, they can go ahead and have one common septic. That's all the bill really does. It seems to make sense to me. Problem is that Goal 11 right now prohibits that from happening. It's effectively what Goal 11 requires is that each dwelling outside of an urban growth boundary is required to have their own septic. Doesn't make a lot of sense. It seems to be a lot more environmentally smart, at least where it's possible, to allow, you know, if you've got a group of 10 homes in an unincorporated area outside an urban growth boundary, that can, it's practical for them to set up a common septic. It seems to me like that'd be fairly smart thing to do. I mean, at least common sense thing to do. Unfortunately, the rule doesn't allow that common sense. Instead, what the rule says is that rural uses are rural uses, and therefore these types of quote public facilities aren't allowed. Bill also allows, where practical, if you can hook up to a municipality sewer system, it allows that as well. You may hear opposition to the bill saying this is going to encourage urban sprawl and rural splatter, which are apparently really bad things. Unfortunately, those arguments, at least in my opinion, are red herrings, because it only applies to dwellings that currently exist. In other words, it doesn't change any of the siting standards for siting a dwelling in EFU or forest land. These are only for existing dwellings. It's not a backdoor way, one of Oregonians in Action's sneaky ways to try and get more homes on property so people can, God forbid, live on their property. It's just, at least in our opinion, a common sense solution to what isn't a common problem, but at least one of our folks out in Sisters had this problem, and I understand, although I'm not familiar with the case, there's a fellow in Jackson County, a group of landowners who are having a similar problem as well. That's the bill in a nutshell, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zoner.
So DEQ would still have, they'd make the decision whether it's practical or not, so they're the oversight on this thing?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a comment.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, the comment I'd like to make is that in Southern Oregon, there is a company that is presently designing and is marketing in China a system where a number of homes in a neighborhood will provide or would flow all of their sewage and gray water to a location. It then gets processed and it comes out with drinkable water and fertilizer that is purified. I mean, that has been disinfected. And this has tremendous potential in China, where they don't have any infrastructure, but it also would be the kind of thing that could be used where you have a group of homes that are existing in a rural area and their septic systems are failing. And we have to take action about the pollutions taking place from failing septic systems. And so it sounds like this would allow that kind of new technology to be applied in a current circumstance.
Russ, let me ask a question, too.
Sure.
And I'll use Klamath Falls as an example, where we have approximately 25,000 residents outside the city limits in an unincorporated area. This would, I'm assuming, allow those 25,000 people that live outside the city limits to go to one sewer system. I guess that's the first question, then I have one more.
It may, and I qualify that because you would still be required to get DEQ's approval, and it would still you'd still have to show that you'd still have to meet whatever DLCD would define as a cluster and those sorts of standards. So to the extent that those 25,000 people living outside the EGB can show that they're clustered and that they can satisfy DEQ's requirements, and yes, it would allow that.
Would this promote, and perhaps you can tell me, is there a minimum maximum number of dwellings to form a sewer district? It would appear to me that this would promote forming a sewer district if you were dealing with X number of homes.
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the requirements for forming water and sewer districts are. So,
okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenler.
You stated in your testimony that this only applies to existing dwellings. It looks to me that it applies to any dwellings anywhere in a rural area and any future dwellings anywhere in a rural area. Where is the limitation on it only applying to existing dwellings?
Let me revise my remarks. It applies to any lawfully sited dwelling, so it doesn't change the siting requirements that are currently in a statute and in rule. In other words, you still have to meet, for instance, the $80,000 farm income test in order to get your dwelling sited. And then if you're able to build your home there's a whatever is defined, a cluster is defined as, if you're able to establish that a cluster exists, then those homeowners would be able to develop their septic. But it's not intended in any way to modify or make it easier for somebody to actually build a home. Just once you get a home built, or if you have a home currently existing, if this is possible, it allows you to establish a common septic.
May I follow? You use the term septic, but this, of course, uses the term sewer systems or any other alternative sewer disposal method. But my reading of this is that you could now go anywhere in a rural area, the only restriction being that it was economically feasible to connect and create municipal or quasi-municipal sewer systems. Is it?
I think that
that's the effect of it, isn't it? Whether it's desirable or not, that's not the issue. But
I don't know that I would, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I don't know that I would agree with that broad interpretation of the measure. It's not intended to suddenly allow sewer systems crop up all of a sudden out of nowhere. If, as I said in my earlier testimony, if it's practical, if it's possible for you to hook up to a municipal sewer system, that makes sense. I mean, why dump sewer into a septic if you can put it into a sewer system? Also, accordingly, if rather than having, if you've got 10 dwellings out in the middle of EFU, and rather than having 10 individual septics, and if they can establish one common septic, which would be somewhat more environmentally friendly, why not do that? It doesn't establish that they have to do it. I mean, if those 10 farmers out there or whoever decide that, yeah, we'd rather have 10 septics, they can go ahead and do that too. It just allows them an option.
Thank you, sir.
I might mention, had a little bit of experience with this as a county commissioner in the city of, or the unincorporated area of Chemult, Oregon, which is located on Highway 97. One of the important ingredients that we really haven't talked about, or criteria, is the cost of putting in a sewer system that for many rural areas, such as Chemult, which has around 300 or 400 people that live there year-round, the cost of installing a sewer system for that community was cost prohibitive in that the sewer rates would have gone up tenfold for each individual who are very happy at that point with their own sewer system. But if you get an area that is commercially oriented, that's where your sewer system, I think, comes much more into play than on a residential basis. At least that's based on my own experience with that small city. Sewer systems are very expensive to put in, and if you get on a sewer system, it's going to cost you an arm and a leg to do it. And at least that's what I found in Chemult.
That's been my experience too, Chair Gerard.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, you seem to confine the scope of 3016 to alternative sewage disposal systems. However, sub 1B also says that these clusters of homes may also be served by a system established by a nearby municipality or an unincorporated community. Let's look at the municipality piece on that. Do you mean that the municipality would have the authority to extend its sewer lines outside of its city boundaries to pick up these cluster homes? Is that what you intend by that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I think there's an assumption in your question, that is, to the extent that the cluster of homes is willing to pay that, you know, for the cost, which I'm assuming the municipality would impose upon those folks, and to the extent that it's practical, I would say yeah. The answer to your question is yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So in this scenario, I just have a couple follow-up questions. Because, by way of background, a substantial part of my legislative district is in an unincorporated but urbanized area of Lane County. About 10 years ago, the city of Eugene extended sewers and compelled payment for those sewers, even though we weren't part of the city of Eugene. That led to a series of litigation I was involved in, so it has to be clear to me what we're doing, because right, there are some limitations on whether a city can extend its sewer lines beyond its boundaries. I want to make sure if that's what you're contemplating, and I think your answer is yes, that could be a possibility.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, yes, that could
okay.
be possible.
And consistent with that possibility, then the users of the new sewage facilities would have to bear the costs through Bancroft bonding or some other financial vehicle. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, yes.
Okay. Now, you also say that something called an unincorporated community would have the same authority, that is to serve these cluster homes by a sewer system. I don't know what an unincorporated community is. I don't recognize that as a legal entity.
Metzger up in the Portland area is an unincorporated community. It's a community in Kaiser for years was an unincorporated community in incorporated Marion County. I would agree, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I would agree that an unincorporated community may not have the same legal standing as a municipality, but it's my understanding in the law that an unincorporated community in some instances is recognized.
But I don't recognize an unincorporated community as having a governing body that could you know, pass ordinances or resolutions to extend its sewer system into these cluster homes. That's where I'm coming from. If there's something there I don't see, okay, but that's why I'm asking the questions. I don't recognize that as a legal body.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, why don't I research that issue a little bit further and get back to you on that?
Yeah, and if I could make one suggestion, Mr. Chair, the authority of a city to extend its sewer system beyond its boundaries is already provided for in ORS 224.020. To some extent, this is a duplication, and I will give you the name of a case that you should look at, because what you're missing here, and everyone's missed it, including the city of Eugene, is that the authority to extend sewers outside your boundaries does not mean you can compel the homeowners to hook up. Sometimes they have to hook up before they can be assessed, and that's a holding of the case. You might want to look at that and make sure that if this is a viable opportunity, that at least it's will accomplish what you want it to accomplish. I can get it to later on.
Okay.
Or you can just come up and get it.
That would be my interpretation of the proposed bill, is that there's an option there for mm-hmm. the property owner, because it does say may on line 10.
Yeah, the municipality may, but once they form the improvement districts and enter into the assessment process, basically you're compelling the sewer system upon persons that do not have the right to vote in that municipality. It's an extraterritorial extension. So the case that I've mentioned here sets up different parameters to protect the public in that.
Ross, will you look at that?
Mr. Chair, I will.
Good. Okay, thank you. Any other questions of Mr. Day?
Thank you.
Bob Rindy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I wanted to mainly just give you some of the background of the discussion that LCDC has had on this. They have opened Goal 11 twice since, I think, 1995 was the first time in 3 or 4 years later to discuss this question. And
Goal 11, Mr. Chair?
Goal 11 is a... Yes. Goal 11 being the statewide planning goal that pertains to public facilities and services. So in Goal 11, we have... Most of what Goal 11 is about is generally to try and make sure that cities provide and plan for public facilities for all the areas within the urban growth boundaries, but it also has provisions about rural areas. And this is not an easy question, and I know that you're probably seeing that already.
There seems to be nothing easy in this committee.
what the commission heard and discussed, what LCDC heard and discussed in those two instances, were some of the things that I wanted to just tell you about, and so that you will consider them as you consider this bill. Clearly, there are many rural residential areas in the state. There are about 750,000 acres of rural residential areas in throughout the state. Many of those areas are sort of intertwined with farmland and forest land. There, if you were to look at the maps, you'd see sort of checkerboard patterns going out vast distances from the urban growth boundaries in the valley and elsewhere. And most of those residential areas are zoned and developed at this point with 1, 2, or 5 acre lots. And generally the people living out there are in fact looking for a rural lifestyle. That's the kind of density that they want. And provided those homes are served by wells and sewer systems, on-site sewer systems, the costs to those homeowners are fairly low, certainly compared to municipal residents who are paying for sewer services and all the rest of those services. The struggle here is it really has to do with the nature of urban growth boundaries and what they really mean if outside of an urban growth boundary, we might see sewer lines snaking for vast distances across farmland to serve clusters of homes. I think the term clusters is, while that's in your bill here, it doesn't mean anything, because the way it's defined here is a cluster is simply something that for which it's economically feasible to serve with sewer. To me, that doesn't describe what most of us think of as a cluster. It doesn't define some clustered area where homes are near each other and then surrounded by perhaps areas that have open space. It has nothing to do with geography or the physical features. It has simply to do with economic feasibility. We heard from many parties in our discussions that one of the biggest problems with small sewer systems that are established by 10 homes or 20 homes or whatever the number might be in these isolated rural residential areas is long-term maintenance. A city, of course, or a municipality in putting together a sewer system, that's an endeavor that it requires not only high initial cost to pay for that system, but if it's well managed, a system to make sure that over the long term that it will be maintained and it will continue to function. And what we heard from DEQ and others was that this, as you get to very small systems, especially those that are maintained by just a few residents and completely supported by them, is that over time those do tend to fail. The maintenance isn't done, and generally when that happens, there is no way to replace that or repair it without public funding. And so even though this bill by no means is going to draw a lot of the scarce public funding for public facilities initially, in the long run, that will be a consequence. You will have public dollars that will have to go out to those areas over a period of time. The provision of sewer lines across distances outside of farmlands, if we are to serve these clusters from cities, is also, while it may be economically feasible, and I'm not sure what that term means, it's, I think without question, you'd have to agree that it is far more expensive per unit to do that. To the degree that urban growth boundaries cluster development in a compact area, it is primarily for public to conserve public expenditures, and it is more efficient to serve a large area like a city with a sewer system than it would be to serve a series of scattered clusters and at distances outside that boundary. So while it is possible, it is feasible, it is going to be more expensive for the public. The only other thing that I wanted to point out here, municipalities in here indicating that municipalities may provide sewer connections. I didn't have time to try and find those statutes. I've been told, and I will continue to try to look for this, but I've been told the municipality in some places may be defined to simply include a district. So it's not simply a city that this term refers to, and that's something that you might want to check with your legal counsel, because it may indeed mean that if you set up a district, a sewer district of any size, that's a municipality. So for that in that regard, I don't think there are any limits to this. I think what this bill ultimately means is all of the 750,000 acres of land outside urban growth boundaries could be served by sewer, provided we can find the private dollars and ultimately, I'm afraid, the public dollars to serve them. Those are the issues that LCDC wrestled with, and where they ended up in Goal 11 was to have some limits on sewer lines. They are allowed, sewer systems are allowed without limits inside unincorporated communities today, and they are allowed with no limits to anywhere where there's a health hazard, and they're allowed, of course, inside urban growth boundaries. And so, for example, the area in Klamath Falls that you spoke of, Mr. Chair, that's all inside the urban growth boundary. Mm-hmm. So that's all, and much of that area does have some sewer to it, but it's certainly not prohibited.
Well, I can give you a good example of exactly what you're talking about. About 17 miles north of Klamath is an area called Modoc Point, which has maybe 10 residences that are located right around a lake, Upper Klamath Lake. They created a sewer district 15 years ago, and because there was no future maintenance plan by the sewer district, the entire system deteriorated, and what we had eventually was raw sewage being dumped into Upper Klamath Lake, and there was no money to repair that other than to go to the county, which had the jurisdiction over that particular area. So I think you're absolutely right in pointing out future maintenance is a very important issue because it can come back and cost local government money to repair these systems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a good example of what I was talking about. To conclude, I don't. The department is. We're not going to take a position, and certainly, given the controversial nature that we had in our own hearings, and say this is something you shouldn't do. But I did want to just point out those drawbacks. I'm not sure. It might be that you might want to adjust this language, given some of those concerns, and that's the main reason that I'm bringing them to your attention. It would be possible for you to try to deal with those. The Section 2 of this bill is already law. I don't know why legislative council would put that in there. We certainly don't oppose it, but that's the way we have operated, and I think all agencies operated. There, no administrative rule is enforceable if it conflicts with statute, and indeed, every time a statute is adopted that would be contrary to one of our rules, we change it, and we don't believe we can enforce it in the meantime. So I'll just mention that. It's a certain language you don't need, but it doesn't change anything.
Any questions of Mr. Rindy?
I have one question. Chair Gerard, Mr. Rindy, while you're here, could you help me have a little bit more information? It hasn't really been brought up, but it has from other experience I've had about problems that are developing in Oregon from septic systems that are failing and the pollution that is causing in groundwater. Can you tell us what your department's research has been on that?
Chair Gerard, Representative Richardson, I'm by no means very expert in that. When we had hearings on this, we've asked people who can tell us about those things to come in. And generally what I'm hearing is, what I understand to be the situation is, yes, over time septic systems do fail. And either that means you take care of that with a repair or with a new system on site. And if that can't be done, you ultimately have a health hazard. And that is certainly the reason why the current rules and currently Goal 11 by no means prevents sewer extensions to health hazards. Whenever that happens, there is no right now, and it does happen in many places, you can set up a new sewer system or run a sewer line. That's already authorized.
Okay, follow up. Okay, I'll save for another time getting more information about that, because I was told in like Tillamook and some different areas that there's a real problem with failing septic systems and how that's affecting groundwater. But that really doesn't apply specifically to this. You had mentioned that it's possible that there would be sewer lines crossing vast areas of farmland to clusters, and then you talked about clusters. And of course, you also mentioned that financially, that's probably not a major problem, or at least I'm inferring from what's being said, because it would cost so much to do that, and who's going to bear the cost if not the users? But I am concerned about what you brought up of the potential problem with failure, because I could see some groups getting together and they're a small cluster of homes or whatever, and they say, look, why don't we do this because we need it? And then years later, something starts to be a problem, and you may have different owners, and there could be a refusal to participate in the maintenance, and so now there is a real problem that would develop. Are you aware of any maintenance agreements that could be done or that exist where it would require those that participate to assure that they would participate in future maintenance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'm afraid I'm not very expert in that question, but I'm certain that happens, and it may even be that DEQ tries to encourage it. I'm not sure if they require it, as they, of course, also review anything that would be a rural sewer system that's set up. My understanding is that it's certainly feasible and possible and probably often that a rural area that sets up its own sewer system does it in a way that's very financially responsible, has such agreements, and has a maintenance plan, and I wouldn't want to infer that you couldn't do it. My understanding has been that it hasn't always been done that way for whatever reason, and that's why we do have the failure of these systems that ultimately require public dollars.
And Representative, we're presently trying to see if we can find someone from DEQ, which is the agency really that oversees sewer systems and so forth. And if we can't find someone this morning, when we bring this bill back, we certainly will have someone from DEQ that can answer. Representative Zoner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was kind of my question. DEQ is going to oversee this. Do you feel confident that they'll make the right decision, whether they allow the, you know, the building of these things? How do you feel about that?
Representative Garrard, Zoner, I think that DEQ probably has is pursuing this problem that we just described, and probably has some programs in place to try to limit these kinds of problems. I don't know. I don't know whether, to what extent, the failures that we hear about, such as the one that the chair just described, are due to systems that were set up before current rules, whether DEQ currently has rules that, that get a handle on this. I do think you need to hear from DEQ. I'm just reporting to you that this failure problem is one of the reasons that LCDC, as they considered this question, decided to limit these rural systems to communities, actual unincorporated communities that are planned as such, or to health hazard areas. But it may very well be that as DEQ moves forward with rules or programs to try to take care of these problems, that this will be less of a concern in the future. And I would ask you to ask some of those experts. I don't deal in that kind of situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions, Mr. Rindy? Seeing none, thank you, Bob. Kerry? See, I'm on a first name basis with you now. We're getting to know each other.
I'm sorry about that in some way. Good morning, Chair Garrard, members of the committee. My name is Carrie McLaren, staff attorney for 1000 Friends of Oregon, and yes, here enough lately to, because of all your 100 plus bills, to be on a first name basis. We have some concerns about this bill, many of which have been addressed by either your questions or in previous testimony. I just want to sort of start with a basic premise that I think is important to remember, as I'm sure you do in reviewing these, which is that the Oregon Land Use Planning Program is based on a policy that urban development will take place inside of urban growth boundaries and that areas outside urban growth boundaries will be reserved for farming, timber, ranching, and rural areas, those sort of rural communities and rural lifestyles that some people really are looking for. As Mr. Rindy stated, Oregon currently has over 750 acres of private land zoned for rural residential use, which is slightly more than the area that we have inside our urban growth boundaries. I have the numbers here in terms of an additional, 7,000 acres of rural commercial and about 58,000 acres of rural industrial lands. As I read the bill, actually, it is not just limited to those areas that are zoned for rural residential, industrial, or commercial use, but actually it would affect all areas outside unincorporated communities and urban growth boundaries. So it affects EFU zone land and forest land as well. We obviously support the distinction between urban and rural areas. We believe that provides a diversity of land uses, and it also saves considerable tax dollars by avoiding the cost of sprawl and infrastructure costs. There is a study that I've brought, if any of you are interested, in terms of cost of community services that was recently done in Skagit County in Washington. And what they did is they studied the unincorporated communities and the revenues to the county versus the cost of community services, including sewer services to the areas. And they found that for every dollar of tax revenue received from rural residential uses, $1.25 in services was demanded. And so I think that's sort of part of the public policy question, certainly that Representative Ackerman in part brought up, or that Representative Garrard in his descriptions of why some communities have not availed themselves or built community sewer systems where they even could. As Mr. Rindy said, if the purpose of this bill is to address issues where we have public health and safety or public health concerns because of the of groundwater leakage or septic systems failing, current law allows the extension of sewer services in that instance. It also would allow probably the creation of some community system to serve that. I would also note that, you know, there are always advancing systems, and that there's nothing in current law which prevents people from individually making use of those systems themselves. I want to just touch on the sort of demand relationship that occurs in the on-the-ground impacts from infrastructure development to land use patterns. As Mr. Rindy stated, part of the issue that LCDC dealt with was a failure problem, the cost to taxpayer of infrastructure. But it also is that there is a knowledge that development follows infrastructure, that increased capacity for development does create a demand for that. And in some cases, that's a very good thing. When we're talking about shovel-ready industrial sites, we put infrastructure out to them in terms of sewer, water, and transportation, and we're looking for development on those sites. We don't want that same thing to happen in the areas that we've planned for rural levels of development, or certainly for farm and for forest uses. There are a number of bills that you will hear that deal with this issue of extension of public services, and I think some of my comments can be sort of taken broadly to apply to our general concern with what the development patterns are that such infrastructure investments encourage, and the cost to taxpayers for paying for those public facilities extensions. A couple of technical notes, and then I will just close my testimony and be happy to answer any questions. There isn't a definition right now of cluster, and it is only defined by whether or not it's economically feasible to serve those dwellings. I think that is, if we're to go to this approach, we certainly need to work on some definitions there. As was brought up earlier, there's nothing in the bill that limits us to existing dwellings. No, it doesn't change the legal requirements for siting a dwelling, but it certainly does also have impacts in terms of future development. And I just wanted to bring out again that certainly in unincorporated communities, which are defined, I don't know the exact definition, Representative Ackerman, but it's in, I believe, Division 22 of LCDC's rules, which is 660-022. It's a chapter dealing with unincorporated communities, and there are definitions for both unincorporated communities and urban unincorporated communities. And I believe that public sewer and water is allowed within the boundaries of both of those, as well as for any public health issues. So thank you for the opportunity to comment. I'd be happy to answer any questions, except for I'm not an expert on DEQ's regulations.
Seeing none, thank you very much.
Yes.
Ross, will you be able to work on some of the problems on this bill and get it back to us? Good. Okay, thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3016. House Bill 3185 has been withdrawn, so we will not have a public hearing on 3185. Committee floor session this morning begins at 10:30. So it is the intent of the chair that we conclude by 10:15 to give our members time to prepare for a floor session. So now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3302. And Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3302 modifies criteria for determining whether siting a utility facility on land in an exclusive farm use zone is necessary for public service. It requires the owner of a utility facility sited on land in exclusive farm use zone to impose responsibility for restoration of the land to its former conditions required by bond or other security. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Administrator. And we'll start off with Don Schellenberg.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. With me today is Dave Van Ash, from Washington County, a member of our Land Use Advisory Committee. His name is also listed on the hearing schedule there, so you can cross that one off later on down the line. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don't recall if I said my name. I did? Okay. Who I represent? All right, thank you. Get off base here.
Yes, yes.
Careful, the dog. This may not be a good morning for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, 2 days ago I had my granddaughter with me shadowing me, and it was a job shadow thing that she had to do for school. And so then when she got done, then she had this interview sheet that she had to go through with me. And, you know, one of the questions is, you know, what do you like about the job? And then the other question is, what do you most dislike about the job? Today is probably an example of that. Let me begin by saying that the bill as drafted was introduced as a placeholder so that we would have a vehicle available when we determined what we wanted to propose for a solution. So while I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, you putting this on the schedule, we weren't quite ready to move the bill in any case. The current law for siting certain utility facilities was passed in the 1999 session. The agricultural community did not like the bill, but we supported it because we concluded it was the best we could get at the time. We were operating on the premise that half a loaf was better than no loaf at all. Indeed, we were counseled by some not to support it and by others to take the gain available. The only gain was that the utility and not the subcontractor is liable for problems resulting from mitigation. Now it appears that the agreement resulted in us receiving about one quarter of a loaf. The issue surfaced because of a legal opinion referred to as the McCaw case, actually two pieces of judicial decisions, where the judge ruled that when proposing to site a utility facility in a farm zone, the phrase when necessary, because it said you can site a utility in a farm zone when necessary, well, what does the term when necessary mean? And the court ruled that that meant that the service could not be provided by placing the utility anywhere else other than in the farm zone. Then a case called Clackamas Service District provided that in order to meet that test, the utility had to show that all feasible alternatives had been considered. The utilities felt that was an impossible test. It was a black hole. You never knew when you had considered all feasible possibilities. And so a working group was formed which produced a list of six factors, and if the utility met any one of those factors, they were considered to have met the test. As usual, the working group did not include an equal number of property owners, and while we lobbied hard to get the protections we felt were necessary, you can't make water run uphill. And so we took what we could get. One of the deficiencies of the law came to light in the last 2 years as Northwest Natural applied to put in a large natural gas pipeline from Mist to Malala. Two of the factors that allowed a utility to be sited in farm zone were if it had to cross a farm zone in order to have a reasonably direct route to get from point A to point B. And second, it was allowed if there was not public rights of way available. It was our belief that, for the most part, public rights of way, including road rights of way, provided those reasonably direct routes, and crossing farmland would generally not be necessary. Sadly, that has turned out not to be the case in the Northwest Natural Pipeline siting. They successfully argued before the Energy Facility Siting Council that the roads were part of the farm zone, and so they had the choice of placing the pipeline either in the road right of way or on the farmland, whichever suited them. Using that prerogative, they have used road rights of way only about one-third of the time. In addition, they have glibly cited safety concerns as a reason to cross farmland instead of using the road right of way. So you see, Mr. Chairman, there's plenty of work for us left to do because of the decision of the Energy Facility Siting Council and finding out how they would interpret the law, and we now have that, and so now we are beginning to work on amendments. So at the time we do get amendments drafted, Mr. Chair, we would bring them back to you. Thank you.
Don, we do not tend to have a work session on this bill today.
So. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, because this was not the bill we wanted.
I'm Dave Van Ash from Washington County, Farm Bureau member in Washington County on the Board of Directors and also on the state's Land Use Advisory Committee. I guess the reason I'm here this morning is I was directly affected by this Northwest Natural 62-mile pipeline up in Washington County. And I was here during the 99 session, worked with the governor's working committee and House Bill 2865. And I guess we believe that, you know, that strengthened the law to some degree, although, as Don said, there were weaknesses in the law. And now we find out that, you know, with this 62-mile pipeline with Northwest Natural, that according to the hearing officer and Department of Energy's decision, none of it would have had to have been placed in a road right-of-way. The whole thing could have been out in the middle of EFU farmland. And as you know, Farm Bureau supports land use planning system in Oregon and preservation of farm and forest land. And what we have here in the present law, apparently, is at least a legal opinion that you can cite a utility, which we believe is an industrial use, on farmland without even looking at road right-of-ways or any other non-farm areas where this could possibly be cited. And I guess, you know, there's lots of people in this room that are probably going to oppose this bill, but who owns the land here? The farmers own the land, and their property is, in some cases, going to be condemned. The values that they're going to be paid for these easements are going to be, in the case of Northwest Natural, 50% of the actual farm value. And then there's restrictions on what you can do as far as farming activities on top of that easement. And farmers still pay the taxes on it. So, you know, we firmly believe that something needs to be done to improve the law that we have now, because even the Department of Energy and the hearings officer indicated that the law was vague, that, you know, it wasn't a good law.
Any questions of either of our...
Yes, sir.
Representative Green.
Yeah, if I just make a statement, I know this is a bill that's of great concern to my constituents in Western Washington County, so I'm very interested, and I just, let's see if I can do anything to help you get amendments ready or work to get it in a way that both could serve my constituents and also help make sure critical community resources are available. I'd be very happy to be involved, so please just call on me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenwood, thank you for that offer. Mr. Chairman, I might offer just one other thing. Citing utility facilities, there's two different types of utility facilities, those that are linear and those that are site-specific. And the bill has to deal with both of those. And I think that's one of the areas where we maybe didn't do a good job in designing those six factors. In addition to the linear, you can split that between above ground and underground. And there's different concerns between those two. And the bill didn't make any distinction there as well, the current law in the bill in the 99 session. So, you know, we need to take a fresh look at this. And again, when we get something put together, we'll come back and let you know.
Could it be the committee's desire to put any further testimony off on this bill until the Farm Bureau can make their changes, or would it prefer to go ahead and hear testimony in regards to this bill this morning?
Let's hear it again.
Well, the opponents might have more amendments, too. I'd like to hear what they would have to say.
Okay.
Particularly in light of the court decision, I'm a little bit confused about the impact of that.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, John.
Well, one other comment, Chair and Representative Greenlit. It's interesting, the bill you were just discussing about services in rural areas, to rural residential areas, you know, you were talking about sewers across farmland, and that's exactly what we're dealing with here. And one of the situations that seems to occur with these utilities, especially around urban growth boundaries and Portland metropolitan areas, is, you know, the land inside the urban growth boundary in Portland is worth $200,000 to $250,000 an acre. But the land outside that's being farmed is worth $5,000 or $10,000 an acre. So there's a real incentive there to put your utility outside the boundary and outside the road right-of-way, because it's not cheap to install a utility in a road right-of-way. So we're kind of being picked on here because we have cheap land, and then we're being paid cheap prices. We don't get industrial utility core prices out of this. All we get is half the value of the farmland. Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman.
I also have a letter here that I'll pass out that was part of this Northwest Natural case.
All right. Let's see if we can put together a panel, because just about everybody else I've got except one is against this bill. So, I don't see Tom Gallagher
in here. But we could bring up Sean Miller, Roger Martin, and Gary Bauer.
Gallagher promised hours of testimony.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of books.
Oh, okay.
Well, my other thought was you may want the Office of Energy to explain the siting process a little bit.
All right, that might be a very good suggestion. Why don't we do that? Bring up David Stewart Smith and Mike Granary. I don't know whether they're your friends or not, but they just put you right in the seat, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. I'm Mike Graney. I'm Director of the Oregon Office of Energy, and with me is Dave Stewart Smith, who's the Administrator of our Energy Resources Division. And David's division provides the technical review of applications that for decisions made by our Energy Facility Siting Council. That's a citizens panel that makes the ultimate decisions to approve energy facilities, including pipelines and transmission lines. Let me make a few brief remarks, and I'd like David to talk a little bit more about the process and the legislation that led to where we are today and the Northwest Natural case. We oppose 3302 in its current form. And I think we should step back to the bill that was passed in 1999, House Bill 2865, while I think everybody involved had reservations about it. It went through extensive negotiations and participation by all the players involved, utilities, farm interests, state agencies, a number of state agencies, for a process that, on the whole, we think balances the different interests in a reasonable way. I think the recent decision by the Energy Facility Siting Council to approve the pipeline demonstrates that that is a workable process. The Siting Council's review of the pipeline was extensive. Normally, the Siting Council reviews energy facility applications under current law in less than a year. There's a statutory goal of 9 months. In the case of the pipeline, the application itself, Siting Council went through an extensive process to take public comment and concerns into account. It took over 18 months to review the application itself. Prior to that, Northwest Natural submitted information over a period of 2 years previously in terms of route options, route variations, to try to address the issues that were raised by concerns of citizens and farmers along the pipeline route. And in fact, the decision by the Siting Council made major modifications to the initial proposal of Northwest Natural. And in fact, on nearly half the route, the Siting Council required use of the right-of-way near the roads, not otherwise on EFU farmland. So I think the process works. If there are going to be proposed amendments by the bill sponsors, I encourage them to fully involve the other parties so that we can see if a consensus can be reached. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like David to talk a little bit more about our siting process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Stewart Smith. As the administrator for the Energy Resources Division, I also serve as the secretary for the Energy Facility Siting Council. I was asked by the governor's office in 1999 to bring together all of the interests on both sides of this table to come up with what eventually became House Bill 2865. So I was deeply involved in that. It was a hard negotiation process. Clearly, a lot of strong feelings on all sides. The Siting Council's process to consider the Northwest Natural Gas pipeline application has been the major application of that new statute. There have been some small cases in the preceding few years before this, but the council's application of it clearly has been the biggest piece. And the council made some significant judgments and used its conditioning authority that it has under its enabling statutes, as Mike said, to modify the company's final route within a corridor that they had proposed, and they proposed a fairly wide corridor in order to have enough flexibility to successfully build the pipeline once it was, if it was approved. But the council used its conditioning authority to push half of the requested 40-foot permanent easement into the road right-of-way, as Mike said, in nearly half the route. And the rest of the route that was not, that did not include road right-of-way, was dictated largely by points of geography that that must have been met, crossing Interstate 5, crossing the Willamette River, crossing the Tualatin River three times. There are some significant challenges to putting in a pipeline 62 miles long through this area, and those crossings have to be made with borings, directional drilling of a hole 36 inches in diameter. And there are only certain places that you can do that. And those pivot points, if you will, established places within the route that must be met and must be then connected to each other. And that drove a lot of pipeline of routing proposal by Northwest Natural. The council's decision took into significant account the concerns of the public, the concerns of the farming community, and I think the council's decision made a reasonable balance of the protection of farmland and the necessity for a very important piece of critical energy infrastructure. We in Oregon are using more and more natural gas to heat our homes. That's primarily what is driving the need to expand the storage capacity at MIST for the company. And this is an important piece of energy infrastructure. And I think the Siting Council did a good job at balancing all of those interests. So the possibility of taking the process that was hard fought and hard crafted 4 years ago and starting over again is a little bit troubling. I think the one that we have certainly has stood up well and, as I believe, balanced all of the interests well. We'd be happy to answer any questions the committee would have.
Any questions? Seeing none.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You must have done an excellent job. And, Don, I would hope that as you work on this bill that you will include our two guests. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's try Tom Gallagher, Sean Miller, and Roger Mart.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing Pacific Gas and Electric, which is the interstate gas pipeline transmission line that goes through Oregon from the Washington border down to the California border. You're going to hear a lot of different pieces of testimony, and I think everybody is going to try and give you something different other than just repeating the specifics of their operation. My little piece of this is to get you to go back and do a little history bit at a higher level. I think you have a pretty, at one point in time anyway, had a pretty clear policy choice in front of you. If you want to get electricity and gasoline from, or natural gas from their sources into the cities, you have to cross EFU in some way, shape, or form at some point in time. You just can't get from point A to point B by airport with these commodities. So the question is, can you site a transmission line in EFU, or should you not? Should farmland be protected from ever having this happen? I want to walk you through the original statute that came out after Senate Bill 100 and read the language to you. It says the following uses may be established in any area zoned for exclusive farm use. And one of those uses is utility facilities necessary for public services. So it seemed at one point in time the debate was pretty clear to people that to get the electricity or the gas from the dam to the city, you had to go across EFU and it was a permitted use. A series of court cases began to take place because we weren't just talking about transmission lines, we were also talking about other public facilities, which could be municipal facilities. And some of those got a little bit dicier and closer to call when you started looking at people's individual objections to having this particular facility or this use go across their land. And I want to read from one of the cases, one of the seminal cases here, which is Clackamas County versus Clackamas County. It's a land use case, a LUBA case out of Clackamas County.
And what they're doing is they're interpreting this language, utility facilities necessary for public services. This is at the point we begin to go down the land use rabbit hole. The case says that there are three possible interpretations of that language. Okay? The first one is that a facility must be found to provide a necessary public service. All right, you need gas and electricity in the city, so you'd meet that test. The second possible interpretation, or the second meaning, was that the term requires a finding that it is necessary to locate the facility in EFU zone. Okay, maybe just a little bit further away from the first interpretation. The third one is that the contends that the phrase means a facility that is necessary in order for an entity to provide a public service. I submit to you that's kind of three different ways to look at this problem of how you're going to go about deciding whether or not you get to run a pipeline or an electric wire across there. EFU. And I'm glad that the Department of Energy came first and explained how the compromise came about last time, which was deciding what this word necessary meant. And they set out a series of criteria which hopefully ended this debate. Is it necessary to put it here, or is it necessary to put it there? And I'm going to look at 3302 and show you that we're now, that the Farm Bureau wants to parse this down even further and take this necessary for each quarter mile segment of the facility. Now, I just submit to you we've come a long way from saying to get the transmission facility sited from the point of generation to the point of use, and to how we're beginning to have to carry on this debate through our land use laws. I sat through some interim committee hearings, two or three of them. Each side, Bus City and the farmers, came in and debated that Northwest Natural. One said, we live in the farmland, you should site it in the city, that's who it's for. The city came in and said, you should site it in the farmland, that's where there aren't a lot of people, well, not a lot of disruptions, it's less inconvenient for everybody if you dig up farmland and put it 4 feet underground and let them farm over. And I submit to you that you can never please both of these constituencies, and that you really need to go back and look at the beginning problem. And I think that I'm going to come back and say that the compromise that we came out with in 99 is a compromise that sets up a process that helps, that puts it in the hands of a special group to balance out these competing social needs and say, what's the best place to put this? Let me leave you with these last two points. When you are siting a natural gas pipeline, I think you have two policy questions to ask first. Do we need it? Do we need another electric transmission line? Do we need another gas line coming into the communities? If you decide that yes, you do, then the second question really should be, how do you do it in the safest way possible? Because if you're siting a natural gas pipeline and something goes wrong with that pipeline, it is a dangerous facility at that point, a dangerous activity. When people dig in the ground and hit it, when it's run on unstable soil, when it's turned and cranked in many different ways, you can create a significant safety problem. The third public policy issue should be, given those two, what's the best place to put it that serves the biggest social good? I would not want one of these run across my property. I don't want an environmental e-zone put on my property. I don't want a 50-foot setback put on my property. I don't want height restraints and constrictions put on my property. But for the public good, we do that all the time. And each and every one of those cases are done for a greater good than the good of the individual property owner. And I don't know how you can solve these cases any differently. Thank you.
Rogers?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent the Williams Company, the other interstate gas pipeline company that goes through Oregon. And I also represent Consumers Power and Central Electric Co-op, both electric co-ops in the state of Oregon. I would suggest to you that this is a very well-intentioned bill that in the end is inevitably going to be bad public policy, and I'd like to explain why. First of all, speaking for the two electric co-ops, Sandy Flicker, who has signed up, and I hope she has a chance to speak. She signed up with me, Mr. Chairman, has a map that shows you where the electric co-ops are in the state of Oregon, and they're everywhere in the rural areas of the state because they were put in to serve the Farm Bureau members who couldn't get electricity from Sean Miller's company and other private utilities 100 years ago when they built their systems exclusively in urban areas because that's where it was. And the federal government came up with a policy, low interest loans, to build electric co-ops to serve the rural area, and now they don't want our transmission lines. Now, I know that's not the intention, but that's they put a handicap on extending those lines. The Williams Company runs border-to-border in two parts of the state of Oregon, almost exclusively through exclusive farm use territory, and that's exactly where it should be from a safety standpoint. You know, all of us need electricity, gas, water, and telephone services, but for the most part, none of us want those lines to be anywhere very close to us. That's called NIMBA, not in my backyard, and I think that's really what's behind all of this. I don't think the drafters of the bill intended to do it, but I point out on line 21, they removed the term for public health and safety. That's exactly what you have to think about with a pressurized natural gas transmission line. And I talked to Jack Dent, who is the father of safety in the state of Oregon with the Public Utility Commission. They're very much opposed to this bill, and he emphasized, in his opinion, instead of removing safety and public health, we ought to be emphasizing that point. And he said to me yesterday, do people forget what happened up in the state of Washington in Bellingham? Or the natural gas problem that happened down in Arizona. These large pressurized lines are potentially dangerous. The previous speaker just talked about earth movement and so forth. Two times in the last 5 years, the Williams Company pipeline coming down through the state of Washington has been moved by earth movements. Both times there were large explosions and fires. Both times no one was hurt because they were in exclusive farm use areas. Nobody was around. You don't want to put these pressurized lines in the ground, in right of way, that might be changed. And I think Gary Bauer from Northwest Natural Gas will testify that one of the things that wherever they could, the siting people put these lines on roads that probably in the future are not going to be changed. But in the urban area, that doesn't cover a lot of areas. They need to be out of those right of ways. I can just tell you that there's a real necessity for the storage facility the Northwest Natural Gas is trying to build this pipeline to. They're taking it off Williams Interstate Line in the area of Monalo, Oregon, and they've got to get it to Mist where there are underground storage areas. We need to store that gas that can be stored during times when we're not at peak load, because our pipeline, by the time it gets to Southern Oregon, has very little gas left in it. I participated during this interim in an attempted project to build a generating plant in Medford, and you can't get enough natural gas to Medford to build a 250-megawatt plant. So there's the point that has been made earlier. There's an increasing use of natural gas. We need it. Coos County, right now, with authority from the legislature, is trying to build a pipeline down to Coos County to give them, for the first time, natural gas service. These pipelines have got to go somewhere, and you've got to remember the safety factor. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate this opportunity to speak.
Mr. Miller. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent PacifiCorp, an electric utility that operates in Oregon as Pacific Power. We also oppose the bill, House Bill 3302, on the grounds that it would all but eliminate the siting of electrical facilities in land zone for exclusive farm use zoning. I'll address my comments to the transmission lines getting our power to our customers. And we do feel that current law appropriately balances the interests of the utilities and their customers. I'm not going to focus on the bill because based on Mr. Schellenberg's testimony, obviously that's going to change, so I'm not going to address the bill. But I do want to state for the record that utilities do need this reasonable level of flexibility in siting their facilities, particularly the transmission lines, in order to keep costs down and ensure safety and reliability. We believe the bill goes too far, and I understand the intent, but it does go too far in limiting land zone for exclusive farm use zone as an option for siting electric facilities to the detriment of utilities and their customers. including those customers located within exclusive farm use zones, such as the farmers who require a substantial amount of electricity to irrigate their crops. And so, again, Mr. Chair, on behalf of Pacific Choir, I respectfully request the committee to oppose House Bill 3302, and we'll be interested in seeing what the Farm Bureau comes up with amendments.
Any questions?
Yes, sir.
Representative,
brief question. Do you cite other facilities besides linear facilities on the EFU?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, I'd have to see, and it'd probably be an appropriate question for for the Department of Energy to see how many have been cited, but I know mostly running the transmission lines.
I was just trying to. We heard there were linear plus others, and mm-hmm. I wondered what other kinds there were and whether it was common for you to be citing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlink, most electric co-ops have substations that are located all over in exclusive farm use zones.
You've got to put the
substation in where you transform the transmission level of electricity down to the distribution level, and they're in exclusive farm use areas. All utilities have to do that.
And would fall under this bill as written.
It would just make it a lot more difficult to cite these. And it's the NIBA thing. We all want it somewhere else, but safety has a lot to do with it, and it's got to go someplace.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. We'll bring forth Sandy Flicker, Willie Tiffany, and Amanda Rich. And then Gary, you'll be following. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Co-op Association, and I will be very, very brief with some comments. Mr. Martin already addressed some of the co-op issues, but the main thing I want to do is show you the map that's attached to my testimony of the service territory of electric co-ops in Oregon. All of the dark gray area is where we serve. So as you can imagine, we serve in all but three counties in Oregon, and most of the utilities serve electricity in multiple counties. And that is one of the reasons we have a significant problem with House Bill 3302, because of that fact that we serve in multiple counties. One utility, a very small utility, Columbia Basin Electric Co-op, that's in Heppner, Oregon, serves in five counties. Wheeler County is about 98% special assessed property, either EFU or exclusive timber use zones. Morrow County is about 80% EFU, and Gilliam County is even higher than that. So that's the only property they really have available to them, and they serve, as you can imagine, a large percentage of the agricultural community. So in addition to the expense of what is outlined in 3302, because of their multiple counties and because of the mitigation plans, they all are very small and have very small staffs. They also believe it could cause some significant delays to the agriculture community, who, when they need an extension of power out to them, they need it quickly, and they do believe that this could also cause extreme delays in getting that power out to them. So with that, I'm not going to address any more in that bill. I hope that we also will be included in a work group to that meets on this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. And again, I'll be brief as well, as we don't know what the final form of this bill will look like. Our interest in this bill is basically with water lines. Many municipalities' water sources are a significant distance from the urban area that they serve. City of Portland would be one. In fact, the water we drink here in the capital comes from 30 miles up the San Diego Canyon, and it needs to cross farmland to get here. We were involved in the work group in 1999 and do agree with Mr. Schellenberg that there were plenty of half loaves to go around, and that siting a utility facility under this process is a difficult one for the utilities as well. However, does have some protections in there, not only for the farmland, but for public health and safety that have already been mentioned, that are very important. Basically, we would also like to be included in any work group that would be formed on the bill. And as the bill's written, we would obviously oppose the bill. Again, reiterating that the Department of Energy did do a very good job in 1999, and it was a very controversial process coming to the utility facility siting process that we have today. And I also want to make it clear for the committee that from a municipal perspective, we do have lots of other types of utilities. But this, from our perspective, this is really designed for those linear facilities, and for us that means water supply. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none.
Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. We represent over 900 districts, including over 300 water and sewer districts. And as with Willie and the League of Cities, that is our main reason for being here, is that this bill would directly affect our water and districts and sewer districts and transmission of those services. I won't reiterate what has been said before about the extensive process that that was gone through in 99. We did participate in that as well, and in fact ended up sponsoring the bill, or putting forward the bill that eventually passed in 99. But I would just say that I would urge you to look at the language that was created during that compromise process. It does create a balanced process and takes into account a number of different factors. The language that is replacing that process in this bill, and I understand it's going to be changed, and we would like to participate in any work groups that that would create that new change. But the language that is being replaced is very limited, and as Willie mentioned, does not really effectively apply to all of what our water utilities do. Not all of our transmissions are direct line, quarter mile, or facilities that can be cut up into quarter mile segments. Many of them, as Mr. Schoenberg mentioned, are fixed site entities. And in addition, I'm sorry that Representative Ackerman isn't here because he had wondered what we might change about the bill, but I'll go ahead and put on the record that we're not sure in the bill what best method available means. That is not clearly defined, and we're concerned, does that mean any technology at all, no matter whether it's been tested or not? And so that would be one of the concerns we would want to look at. And then again, the language being removed that relates to cost. Now, that language is very, in the current necessary test standard, that language is very mild, and it says, that cost cannot be the only factor considered, but it does bring it into account. And that's for the benefit of many of the landowners for whom these utilities are being extended. And should we completely disregard all costs? That's a public policy question for you to consider. In summary, we would just urge that you not consider the language that's currently there, and that we get a chance to take another look at this.
Thank you. Any questions about FOMOs? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Gary? Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural, and with me this morning is Margaret Kirkpatrick, who is an attorney with the Stoll Reeves Law Firm in Portland. She oversaw our process, kind of going through the whole siting process, and she has this specialty, I think, in trying to work through energy or utility facility siting issues. And Mr. Charlie Stinson, who is general manager of our engineering services and storage development, and he is the ultimate employee responsible for the project. We are appearing in opposition. I won't try to go through all of the things that that have been covered, so we're kind of going to, this may be a little disjointed, we're shifting our comments as we sat in the back of the room to accommodate you. Quick comment, though, on ORS 215.275, the law that came out of the 99 session. I think, as people said, it didn't adopt any single party's viewpoint. It definitely was a compromise. And the other thing it does is it does recognize that each utility facility that's cited, it carries with it its own set of unique circumstances. And as a result, that's why there is a balancing process and a set of criteria in which you measure it for. They didn't write the law to deal with a specific facility, and each one will be unique when you try to cite it. A couple of quick comments about our project. It is approximately 62 miles in length. This phase of the project goes from roughly North Plains over to Molalla. It goes that way, as was mentioned earlier, to connect a storage field that we have in the mist area, and we do inject gas back into the ground for storage, take it out during the peak season. The other thing this pipeline does is it also reinforces our system throughout the western part of the Portland metropolitan area. Our fastest growing areas include Washington County, Clackamas County, and the portion of Marion County. So it's not, its location is important in terms of going through that. Mr. Simpson can comment on that if we need to do some more. When we filed our application, before filing that, I think as the Office of Energy mentioned, we actually started back in 1999 and identified a number of corridors as possible routes for this project. And we filed a notice of intent with the Oregon Office of Energy. And from that, they came back and provided us some more input and asked for more information to be studied. We added three additional corridors and routes to look at. Throughout that process, we held public meetings. We did mailings to property owners, affected property owners throughout the area. And kind of, an end result was we looked at all those. We took those into account. We modified our eventual application. We extended the route to take into account comments that we received from the general public. And that final application ended up being eight binders long, an entire shelf full of documentation related to that route. And then that started another, what turned out to be 18-month process of going through, and again, holding public meetings, hearings, reviews by all the affected governmental entities of that application, and then culminated about a week and a half ago in a final decision from the state. And with that, maybe I'll just stop and leave with Mr. Stinson if he wants to add some comments about the siting process.
For the record, I'm Charlie Stinson, General Manager of Northwest Natural. And I'll just make a few comments about the current siting process. We just went through under the current siting rules. And to do that, first, I think I'd give you a little context about the reason for this pipeline project. Gary mentioned that it is this project is primarily there to connect with our storage facility at Mist. This storage facility is a critical regional infrastructure, not only for Oregon, but also for the Pacific Northwest. It's one of two underground storage facilities in the Pacific Northwest. It provides about 25% of the gas required on a peak cold day currently for Northwest Natural's consumers. We also have additional capacity that's being used for other customers in the interstate market. We have development plans to expand that capacity at Mist, but because we are currently pipeline limited, we can't utilize that capacity. So this pipeline project was an integral part of this expansion plans to really double the capacity of Mist storage and have a bigger play in the regional market as well as for Northwest Natural's customers here in Oregon. I guess I'd like to reiterate what Gary said about the difficulty in siting a 62-mile intrastate gas transmission line under the current siting requirements. And I would submit to you that the siting process we just completed with the amount of public review, the information that we supplied into the public record, the process we went through was more extensive than the federal process for interstate pipelines as regulated by FERC. And that was done because of the existing
regulations here in the state of Oregon. That process really led to a balancing of multiple factors, including the primary balancing game between land use and safety. And you have to understand that a high-pressure natural gas transmission pipeline has some unique safety features, unlike other utility facilities, and that became a critical element of this this siting process. And in fact, the current regulations do look at, or does look at, public safety as a as an element in the siting process. So, and I also want to point out that our key regulator for pipeline safety is Oregon, the Office of, Oregon Public Utility Commission, and they actually weren't involved in the work that was done back in 1999 and coming up with the ultimate siting rules. But because there was an element of pipeline safety in that regulation, the PUC did have a voice and certainly was part of the siting process in this pipeline project, and that did become a key factor. I also want to point out that that we have a requirement, which we fulfilled to the satisfaction of the Energy Utility Siting Council, to mitigate and minimize the impact on farmland. And very early on in the process, we hired an ag specialist team that worked with us to develop a ag mitigation plan and also a post-construction crop monitoring to look at the impacts of the farming practices over the pipeline easement after the construction is in fact completed. So there was an extensive amount of work involved in the effort to mitigate and minimize the impacts on farmland. And I think with that, that concludes my comments. I'll turn it over to Margaret Kirkpatrick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Margaret Kirkpatrick. I'm an attorney with Stolries in Portland, and I have been working with Northwest Natural for most of the past decade on siting of their various MIST facility expansions and pipelines. I'll try to be very brief because I think you've heard most everything you need to hear, but I want to take you back just a little bit further in history than you've gone so far. Back in 1997-98, I worked with the company in permitting the first part of this South MIST pipeline that is going from the MIST storage facility down to the Molalla Gate Station, where it interconnects with Williams. And we had proposed in that earlier process to build about 40 miles of the pipeline, going starting at MIST and going 40 miles and down into Washington County. While we were in the final stages of that permitting process, this Clackamas County Service District case that you heard about earlier came out, and it said that in order to site any EFU lands, you had to prove that there were no feasible alternatives. What the company had to do, because they hadn't done an analysis of every potential alternative, was shorten that 40-mile pipeline by 10 miles and only permit the portions that were in forest land. We couldn't site it in the EFU zone because we hadn't done what this new case said you had to do. That was what led Northwest Natural and some of the other utilities to go to the legislature during the 99 session and participate in the work group that came up with ORS 275, or what was then House Bill 2865. I participated in that task force for Northwest Natural, and I think you've heard nobody was really happy with the result, which means that it was probably not a bad compromise. What we thought was missing from the process was that the members of the task force were solely representatives of the utility industry and agricultural interests. The people that I thought were notably missing were the state agencies who were charged with ensuring the public health and safety is adequately considered. The Department of Geology and Mineral Industries was not there, and they are concerned with the seismic and the soil stability issues. And the Office of Pipeline Safety and the Public Utility Commission staff was not there. Nevertheless, one of the factors in the existing law that allows the use of farmland is public health and safety, and as Charlie and others have mentioned, that was a tremendous there was a tremendous tension in the FSEC proceeding that we just concluded between the protection of farmland and public health and safety. And although we had a 200-foot corridor that we thought we needed for flexibility narrowed down to kind of 20 feet of private easement where there were roads in the corridor and 50 feet for construction, which is very tight. I think the typical construction easement is closer to 100 feet for a pipeline of this size. We we survived, and think that the Siting Council, although it was painful for us, actually did a pretty good job. And I don't want you to get the impression that because the industry is supporting the existing law that it is a picnic. It isn't. It's a very difficult, rigorous process to go through. And the Siting Council used the conditioning authority, the existing law, which was passed in 99, has a provision in it that requires the decision maker to impose clear and objective conditions for the mitigation, the minimization of impacts on farmland and the mitigation. And in this case, the Siting Council used that conditioning authority very aggressively to cut down the scope of the private easement, to use the road rights of way to the maximum extent possible, and to give the mitigation plan that Charlie talked about, you know, the force of the condition that has to be followed. And so when the legislature was done in 1999, I said, I don't know if it's possible to site a utility on farmland in this state, but this at least gives us a fighting chance. And that's what it did. But again, it's a very difficult, rigorous process, and I think it's very important to understand that as you consider the possibility of getting in there and tinkering around with it. Thank you.
Any questions of our panel? Representative?
I just have one general question. I appreciate the testimony giving us background on the technical requirements of a siting project such as this. I just need to know, with respect to the 1990 compromise, could you state for the record what interests were represented in that group?
It was facilitated by David Stewart Smith from the Office of Energy, whom you heard from earlier, and David functioned as a neutral. The other state agency participant was from the Department of Agriculture, but they were not participating, at least in my view, as a neutral. They were with the farm interests. 1,000 Friends of Oregon was represented, and the farm bureaus were represented. I think there were members from Washington, Marion, and Clackamas County. So those were the ag interests, the various farm interest representatives and the Department of Agriculture. The Department of Land Conservation and Development weighed in a little bit, but they weren't as active. Then on the utility side, the League of Oregon Cities was there, the Special Districts Association, Northwest Natural, Pacific Power, PGE was involved, and I think the Association of Oregon Counties was in there some. And this is all from memory. David might be able, he's still here, to give you a more complete list. But again, it was ag interests and utility interests.
How about the environmental community?
Well, 1,000 Friends of Oregon is a public interest group that is the land use watchdog group from a public interest standpoint. So they were there, and I would say that was the environmental community.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
And our final testimony is Ms. McLaughlin from McLaren. I'm sorry. Should have stayed with Carrie, you know?
Good morning again, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie McLaren, speaking on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I will note just at the outset, in response to Representative Ackerman's question about the environmental community, I was not personally involved in that work group because I didn't yet work for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. But I think there is a, so I don't know what environmental issues might have arisen, but we would typically only deal with land use issues and not other, you know, wildlife habitat issues and et cetera. So I just wanted to make that clarification. You've gotten a lot of background today in terms of how this law came about. And I do think that it really was triggered by the decision in the Clackamas County Service District case that an applicant consider all feasible alternatives. And the utilities felt like that was too high of a burden. There was, you know, what in this last case was affectionately referred to, or maybe not affectionately referred to, as the N+1 problem, is there's always something else out there that perhaps you could have considered. And so there was the legislation that is now codified in ORS 215-275. I think that there's general agreement with the principle that came out of the preceding case, the McCaw case, and what is in the beginning section of subsection 1 of 215-275, which says that what we mean by whether or not a utility facility is necessary by, for public service is that it must be sited in an EFU zone in order to provide that service. And so what we then get to is some sort of an alternatives analysis. Well, have you looked elsewhere to see if that utility facility or if that utility service can be sited in a different location? There are a couple of critical elements, and really the current statute requires two steps on the part of the applicant. One, that the applicant first identify reasonable alternatives, not all feasible alternatives, but reasonable alternatives to the proposed EFU location. And secondly, that the applicant make a demonstration that those reasonable alternatives don't work based on one or more of the six factors that are enumerated. Those factors have, in part, locational dependence, public health and safety, other considerations that people have spoken to. Unfortunately, 215-275 turned out not to be a model of clarity, and I think particularly so with respect to linear facilities. There is a difference between, a facility that's just sited in one place versus one that transmits or provides services in a linear fashion, and I think that that's something that should be worked on for clarification. The purpose, in part, from some of the legislative testimony I reviewed from the bill in the 99 legislature said, let's provide a roadmap. Well, I don't know that the best roadmap was really provided in the case of linear facilities. And specifically, the issue that I think was arose in the Northwest Natural case in terms of their pipeline is, are road rights of way considered reasonable alternatives that must be looked at in the course of determining where to go? Many roads in an EFU zone are still zoned. Their underlying base zoning is an exclusive farm use zoning. So if an applicant only needs look at non-EFU alternatives to site their linear facility, well, then there's no requirement, say in the case of an electrical facility, transmission line, that the applicant look to see if that electrical transmission line can be sited in a road right-of-way rather than smack down dab the middle of the field. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's what happened in this last case necessarily, but just to sort of show the contrast of what we're trying to look at in terms of linear facilities. As Ms. Kirkpatrick stated, the provision in the Northwest Natural case that required Northwest Natural to make use of road rights of way came under subsection 5 of ORS 215-275, which really relates to minimization and mitigation factors, not whether or not you need to look to these road rights of way as a reasonable alternative. I think another area that I might mention of clarification is what does it mean by providing a reasonably direct route. These are issues I believe should be clarified by the legislature and would benefit from some additional work from parties. As many of you probably have come to experience, it is helpful to sometimes see how these things play out. And now we've seen both standalone facilities and linear facilities be cited under the statute, and we have some concerns about the present statute and would recommend some work on this issue.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Ms. McLaren. I'm going to wait to schedule a further public hearing on this bill until we see what the Farm Bureau has to offer in their amendments, et cetera, and whether they actually can respond to some of the testimony that we've had today. Don, I'm going to leave that up to you. When you have your bill ready to go, if you'll bring it to me, we'll take a look at that time as to whether we'll reschedule a further public hearing. So we will conclude the public hearing on 3302 and adjourn the House Committee on Environment and Land Use. Thank you.